Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Margaret Locke, she's professor of anthropology at McGill University and the author most recently of Twice Dead, Organ Transplants and the Reinvention of Death. Welcome, Professor Locke.
Thank you very much.
Now, the book Twice Dead is motivated, although not at all exclusively about, the brain death controversy in Japan and comparison to the brain death in North America. Tell us a little bit about what is the Western definition of brain death, and when did we adopt it, and how is it different from how the Japanese adopt it?
That's quite a long and complicated question to start out with.
Well, give us your 10-cent answer for that.
Oh, right. We created the concept rather than adopting it. It wasn't out there already. We really created this concept of brain death in or something equivalent to it. It wasn't quite called that in the early days, but in 1969, right after the first heart transplant was done in South Africa by Christian Barnard in 1968, and when the first report was put out by a Harvard ad hoc committee composed mostly of doctors, they stated in that 1969 report that there was confusion because patients were being kept on the artificial ventilator or artificial respirator, and it wasn't clear whether at some point it would be appropriate to turn that ventilator off. There was also confusion because families were not sure really what condition those patients were in that were on the ventilator. Were they live or dead? And they pointed out right from the start that one of the reasons why it was important to clarify death and relocate it in the brain was in order that organs could be procured for organ transplants. So
so instead of saying that that we're just going to be taking organs from people who are almost dead or who have not died yet but will die after we take their organs, they said, why don't we call them dead so that we can take their organs?
Yes, if you want to put it fairly crudely, that that's one way of stating it. Now, what one has to understand is that the very notion of death itself is a concept. We all tend to assume that death is a fact, that one reads it in human biology, and that there's not much doubt about the prognosis and the declaration. There's certainly not much doubt about the prognosis, and that there's very little doubt when there's a declaration of death made by a medical person, then there's not much to argue about. The heart stops beating and the patient no longer breathes. But the difficulty, but that in itself was a convention that was only really introduced about 200 years ago. Prior to that time, it was usually priests and religious men who determined death, and we used all sorts of techniques that a lot of us have have read about and seen in movies, with feathers in front of people's mouths and nostrils and things like that. And there were arguments about when the moment of death had actually arrived. There always have been, and there still are. But the introduction of the artificial ventilator, the piece of technology that allows people to continue to breathe even when their brain is no longer functioning and they're not getting the signals through to be able to breathe, and possibly there's not blood circulating and the heart may not be functioning properly and other organs may not be functioning properly. But with the introduction of the ventilator, the respiration can be kept going. Patients continue to breathe and therefore to appear as though they are alive in many, many ways, even though it can be determined that there is an irreversible loss of function of their brain, that the brain has been so severely damaged that there's no way in which a recovery will be made. And if you take the patient off the ventilator, they will stop breathing rather quickly and rapidly progress to the condition that we all of us recognize as death, with no heartbeat and no respiration. So what we did by recognizing that the irreversible loss of function of the brain could count as death, this thing that we now call brain death, we in effect moved the progression of dying forward a little bit in time, so that once it was could be medically recognized and established in a way that everyone was satisfied with, that the brain was irreversibly damaged, that could count as death, even though the heart and the respirator and the lungs, thanks to the respirator, were still functioning.
Now, as I understand it, most of the European and Western world had adopted that general brain death definition, a working definition of death, by the mid-80s.
Yes, although there are slight differences, and that's really rather interesting too. I don't take this up to any extent in my book, but the British, for example, use a concept of brain stem death, which means that when the lower brain is no longer functioning, the assumption is that nothing can get through and that the upper brain is in effect irreversibly damaged. So they're concerned about the condition of establishing the condition of the lower brain. In North America, the definition was set up differently, so that efforts are made to establish what is called whole brain death, i.e. that neither the lower brain nor the upper brain are functioning any longer. And that in the long run has proved to present various problems, because it is now well recognized that remnants of activity continue in the upper brain even after the lower brain is totally and irreversibly damaged, and the patient is in effect in what we recognize as a brain death condition. But there is often a little bit of activity left in the upper brain, which has allowed a lot of discussion and a lot of disquiet in some areas about what we really are doing here.
Now, what was the difference in Japan? What happened there?
In Japan, they assumed that they would, the medical establishment assumed that it would move ahead in a similar way to South Africa, Europe, and North America, in that they performed a heart transplant, which was the 100th heart transplant to be performed in the world, and it was just a year or so after the original Barnard transplant in South Africa, and it was initially heralded as a great success. The patient survived for a little while, but died. I can't remember the exact length of time now, but several weeks later, the patient finally succumbed and died, the recipient of the heart. Now, that whole procedure set in train a whole motion of events that opened the door to a massive debate in Japan about this new form of death. And part of the reason it was so controversial right from the start in Japan was that first heart transplant went to court with great fanfare, and the doctor who had done the heart transplant was charged with murder. He was charged with murder, first of all, because it was argued that he had actually taken the heart out of the donor before the donor was dead by the recognized standards. And then as this case became protracted over some years, the argument also then included the recipient, and cases were brought, the case was extended to charge the doctor with having selected inappropriately the recipient who was not so sick that he was in need of receiving a transplant. So it was a very complicated law case, which eventually, after some years, was dropped, but it certainly created a huge public furor. And this was particularly acute because it's quite clear that the doctor did lie about some of the procedures. It's quite clear that evidence was hidden, and that probably a substitute heart was brought forth to be examined when the case was taken to court. So it really opened a big gaping wound in Japanese minds, and that case still lingers in people's minds as an example of extraordinarily bad medicine.
I'm speaking with Margaret Locke. She's professor of anthropology at McGill University and author of Twice Dead: Organ Transplants and the Reinvention of Death. Now, as I understand it from your book, the debate dragged on, and there were many bills in the Japanese Diet. And eventually, now at the very end of the 90s, they've adopted legislation to legalize brain death and organ transplantation from the brain dead. But they've come up with a very different resolution for that than we have.
Yes, that's right. The organ transplant law was passed in 1997, and as you say, after enormously protracted and vituperous debate, so that it was the major ethical issue in Japan, causing a huge uproar for, well, up to nearly 30 years. The law that was eventually passed is one which says that a patient may be counted as dead if they are in a brain dead, if they have been diagnosed as brain dead and they have signed a donor card, which is co-signed by their family. In under those circumstances, that patient may count as dead and organs can be procured from them. On the other hand, if someone is diagnosed as brain dead, they are not counted as legally dead in Japan if they have not signed a donor card, and particularly if the family does not agree. The ventilator will be continued to be hooked up to that patient, and it will only be turned off at such time as the family decides that they no longer feel there's any hope, and that's often 3 or 4 days after brain death has been declared, at which time most of the organs would not be suitable for procurement anyway.
So that's a great deal more power given to the family than we have in the States, except that my understanding is that in the United States, at least, most hospitals will not take the organs, even if someone who has a card or perhaps even an advance directive that says, I want to donate my organs upon entering into this brain dead state, they won't take the organs unless an American family agrees as well. So it seems like they've just made explicit what's implicit in America.
It seems as though that's probably the case. In most American states, there is what is called required request. In other words, when a patient is close to brain death, it is required that the involved medical personnel do find out whether the donor card is signed, and they are required to ask the family if they are prepared to cooperate and go ahead. And the assumption is, the burden of the argument is that if the donor has signed the card, if the potential donor has signed a card, then obviously the family is likely to want to cooperate. And we assume that in most cases this is what happens. And just to slip back to Japan for a minute, the burden falls the other way in Japan, where the assumption is that even if a donor card has been signed by the potential donor, if there is any sign that the family is not wanting to cooperate, and if the family has not actually signed that card, then there's no question that anything will go ahead. So I think there is, although in some ways it may appear as though it's not that different, I think in practice it ends up working out quite differently, because all the weight of societal expectation and medical expectation in North America is towards the idea that a family will follow through with the wishes of their family member who has just died. And medical personnel clearly feel at liberty to argue that it is a very worthy thing to donate organs, and that this is the gift of life, and to not explicitly state that this is what should be done, of course, but to feel that they have the moral right to practice a little bit of encouragement in that direction. And in Japan, it's quite the reverse. The medical people would not intrude in the same way. Now, having said all that, I think that in my experience in intensive care units in both Canada and in America, the people who work there have all told me without exception that if families do prove to be resistant for one reason or another, or if it's not 100% clear that a card has been signed, or if there are language differences, difficulties, communication difficulties, and the family is clearly hesitating, then people have always told me that they would never wheel somebody out to procure organs if there was a resistant family present. And I suspect that is almost without exception the case.
You point to a number of different cultural differences between North American culture and Japanese culture that would explain some of these differences. One is our pragmatic and more commodified approach to life and medicine. You also talk about ancestor veneration and different approaches to death. Can you tell us a little bit about what do you think are the principal factors here?
Okay, again, I mean, these things are very complicated.
Yeah.
What I would like to say at the outset is I don't want to overstress a simple kind of cultural relativism, an idea that there is that it is Japanese culture that works against something which is assumed to be normal and natural, i.e. the donation of organs from someone who is brain dead.
Because I think most people assume when they hear this story that the Japanese are probably just not as modern as we are, that they don't have as a clear understanding of the way the body works. They still have some superstitious notion about spirits and souls, when actually probably Americans are much more religious than Japanese. But
well, that is the case. I mean, there's lots of evidence that Japan is essentially a secular society, and the Buddhism and the Buddhist organizations have not been opposed to organ donation. And America is a society which actively practices religion much more than does Japan. So it's a mistake to just simply start talking about, you know, a modern society versus one that is more traditional. That is a mistake that I absolutely want to emphasize should not be made. And secondly, I think that another of the big differences is that, one of the things that I should also point out is that surveys have been done which show very little difference between the willingness of people in when they are asked, theoretically, if they would donate or not, and if they recognize brain death or not. It's about 50% in America and about 50% in Japan. So these national surveys indicate that, in theory, there isn't much difference. So something very different is going on in practice in the ICUs, and we've already talked about what I think some of those might be. Having said that, there is, of course, a tradition in Japan in which it is assumed that one will respect the body of the bodies of the recently deceased and the bodies of ancestors. These days, ancestors often don't count for much, but the recently deceased do. And part of the respect for those bodies is that they should not be cut up in any way. And if at all possible, they should be buried or cremated as whole, entire bodies without parts missing. One sign of a lot of this tradition has been that the practice of anatomy and of anatomical dissections has a very shallow tradition in Japan. It's something which people have been uncomfortable about doing, and it was only over the last 100 years that anatomy has become firmly entrenched in Japan, whereas, of course, Europe and later North America has a much, much longer tradition of that. And so we have a tradition of commodification of human bodies for the sake of science. And for the sake of progress in the medical sciences, which I think in some ways has probably contributed to people's apparent willingness to donate organs. Again, looking at the other side, it's quite clear when you really talk to people on the front line that there is ambivalence in North America and in European countries too, on the part of both some practitioners and some families. Some people go ahead with donation, but then really wonder what they have done. And we still need much more research to find out whether people do sometimes have second thoughts a year or two later. We just don't know about this. But so I would like to argue very strongly, and I do in the book, that I think there are cultural attitudes at work in both Japan and in North America, and that this really shouldn't be set up as a question of tradition versus modernity.
One would think that, from one perspective, that the Japanese would be far more successful with organ transplantation, and that is that their society characterized by a great attention to the economy of the gift, and a sense of social obligation. They're ethnically homogenous.
Right.
And so as one of the big problems that we have with with organ donation in the United States is that people, aren't sure that the right kind of people are going to get the organs if they donate, people unlike themselves.
Right. Yes, that is the case, that there is hesitation, and explicitly on the part of some people, when asked, that they would like to practice what they call directed donation. They would only like to donate if they can be sure that their organs will go to a named ethnic group or a named community. And the transplant, UNOS, the transplant organization, has been firmly opposed to that, and quite rightly, in my opinion. In Japan, as you point out, one might assume that they would be rather keen, given that it is an ethnically homogenous society, and that that there is a strong tradition of reciprocity, of gift giving, and of a sense of communal cooperation. But as I point out in the book, this tradition of gift giving follows very clear pattern, and it is above all a system of reciprocity, not a system of altruistic giving. And therefore, the idea of donating your organ to an unknown other whose family is not in a position to repay you because of the anonymity is not something that appeals to most people. People really do, in a way, feel that they might be betraying their relative who's died by sending off parts of their body to all over Japan to other people that they have no contact with and can't establish relationships with. And when they did that very first transplant in Japan, the one that turned out so badly, the families met. And one of the first things that the recipient family said to the donor family was that, "I hope we can become close friends as a result of this," because in the early days anonymity wasn't required. And many people in Japan who I've interviewed have said that they would feel comfortable about donation if they knew who the organ was going to. But that's something that we in both Europe and North America have been very, very reluctant to allow people to know where organs have gone for fear of litigation and for fear of trying to put undue pressure on recipient families.
You don't draw very many normative conclusions in your book about brain death, but you do suggest that the apparent consensus around our current definition of whole brain death is eroding, both because of these kinds of evidence that it's not as clear and cut a diagnosis as we thought it was, and also that there are philosophical arguments tugging in different directions on that argument. Well, what's your current speculation about the future of our definitions of death?
I think it's very hard to speculate about that. What I can say is that what I would like to happen is for it to be recognized that it is an individual, a person who has died, and not that their body, their entire brain, is no longer functioning. I personally feel comfortable about organ donation from brain dead bodies. Many, many people these days indicate that they're not so comfortable, but I still, despite all this research, feel comfortable about this. But I think that it is a mistake to equate the diagnostic condition of brain death with human death, because death is not just a biological process, it is also an individual, the end of an individual's life, and it is a social event as well. And I think that I feel that it is quite probably more appropriate to recognize the end of an individual's life and to recognize clearly the situation of irreversibility, rather than to try to argue that the brain is already completely dead, which is more often than not the case.
To switch topics here for a second, you've started work on a whole new set of topics, germline engineering and enhancement and genetic diversity and so forth. And American bioethics is still reeling from the appointment of Leon Cass as the new ethics czar for President Bush, and he has now appointed his own Presidential Commission on Bioethics, which is dominated by various religious conservatives and folks who are staunch opponents of any kind of therapeutic cloning or enhancement technology. I think clearly here in the States there's going to be a ramping up of the battle over those issues. Do you see similar trends happening around the world in Canada, Europe, Japan? Or are these kinds of battles about therapeutic cloning in particular having a lot to do with the right to life movement?
Yes.
Something which is not present in many cases.
Yes. I think that battle will be the most acute in the States, and I would be, I think it's very unlikely that it will take such an acute form in most European countries, and probably neither in Canada too. Canada has, at the moment, does not have regulations, although it is working on regulations against cloning. But the regulations will not be totally opposed to all forms of cloning, and it is possible at the moment in Japan in Canada, to make use of aborted fetuses for various research purposes without much. I mean, it's regulated, of course, but there isn't public outcry about this. In Japan, I would predict very, very little problem at all. Abortion is not a major social issue in Japan. It has been legally recognized, actually, since before the war, and is Japanese feminists are not altogether comfortable with the way in which abortion is recognized in Japan, because it comes under something known as a eugenics law, which leaves a very bad taste in the mouths of many people. But aside from getting that name reformed, the principle of access to abortion is widely accepted in Japan and causes very little stir at all, because people argue rather strongly that one should bring wanted children into the world and not those that for whom you cannot care properly. And so I would be very surprised if there are major restrictions put in place in Japan about this.
Well, rather than opening up an entirely new set of topics here, I want to get a rain check to come back and talk to you more about germline engineering and genetic diversity and gene testing for breast cancer. And I assume that you've got something forthcoming. Can we expect a publication soon? Or
Well, papers will be coming out slowly
okay.
but surely. A book will take a little bit of a time. At the moment, I'm focusing on these kinds of issues that you're talking about, but the specific illustrative example that I have turned to draw on are issues around Alzheimer's disease, and particularly with respect to the new genetics and what it has taught us about Alzheimer's disease so far, turning out to be an example of, in a way, a negative example of how the more we learn about the genetics, the more the situation gets so complex that we, in a way, understand less than we thought we did.
Well, I look forward to that discussion. I've been talking with Professor Margaret Locke, Professor of Anthropology at McGill University, and she's the author of Twice Dead, Organ Transplants and the Reinvention of Death. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, @ changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.